Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, Senior Meditation Instructor Kathy Lamo Jackson continues our series on the lives of the Karmapas, taking a look at highlights from the lives of the 14th and 15th Karmapas, their teachers and students. One of the most important developments of the time was the founding of the Rime movement by Jamgon Khantro Lodro Taye, Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo, and Chogyur Lingpa. This was a non-sectarian movement used to find common ground among the major schools of Tibetan Buddhism, which laid the foundation for the survival of the teachings as many Tibetans eventually were forced to flee their homeland. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So good morning, everyone. So I'm curious how many folks have been able to make it to most of these classes on the Karmapas' lives. Great. And let's see. I'm always into reference material. So I believe this is a book for the class. Do many of you own this book? Any of you own this book? Back in the 70s and 80s, well, actually, this is published in 80. This is one of the very earlier ones that is pretty much almost word for word a lot of these. Well, you don't have to buy any of these books unless you're trying to sell them. You can get all these books, not all the books, but all these amazing stories online. You can go to our website, which is kagyu.org. You could go to Kagyu Office, which is Gyawa Karmapa's website, and they go beautifully through all the different Karmapa's lives. So I just want to let you know that you don't necessarily have to own a book. If you would look up Karmapa Lives or the Golden Rosary, that's another name for all of them. But I'm curious, anyone here doing Ngundro? So it's really lovely. On a lot of those, when you do Ngundro, which is a practice of very closely tied, in my opinion, with the Mamuja lineage prayer we just did, you do 111,000 prostrations. Then you do a practice called Vajrasattva to purify your speech. It's prostrations were to purify your body and your karma, and to start building up connection with our lineage. Next, you do mandala of making offerings of joy for everything. And lastly, Guru Yoga, where your mind and the Guru become one. In all of those, we often go through the texts, and some of them are really long because they're listing all these people part of the Golden Rosary of the Kagyu lineage. Well, if you go to these websites, they have every little teacher that was on there. I always used to wonder, who is that? And I would look them up, and now everything is just so available online. So if you're ever interested, you can ask me or others here. How to get, you know, where online to find these, because it's just astounding. So today I thought I should talk a little bit about these books. Have any of you ever read stories about Milarepa, the yogi Milarepa? Those type of books are not normal books. They're not even what in Westerners would call hagiographies, which are books of saints. The Tibetans call them nantars. It's N-A-M-T-H-A-R. And the translation means complete liberation. The real name is Namparthapa, but we just call them nantars. And so these books aren't exactly like today we're going to talk about the life of the 14th and 15th Karmapa. It doesn't walk through their life kind of in a normal way, like they were born in Columbus and, and who their parent. They do talk a little bit about where they were born and their parents, but they talk about signs and things with and miraculous things that happened in their lives. They talk about who their teachers were, how their entire lives were dedicated to the Dharma, how they served so many people, who they learned from, who they gave their lineage on to, and all that. So I just want to let you know that these are stories of the yogis and the great saints. And so they might be a little dry at first, but try and look at it as more of, I would say, like a sacred recording of inspiration. These are stories of inspiration, of beings that might not appear completely what we call normal. They're very, very special beings. And the key is, these are examples of spiritual life. So I did want to make sure you knew about that. I remember when I lived in India years ago, I was with a lot of translators. I was not a translator. And they all talked about these namtars, and they were working on them, and how different they are than how we normally think of saints and special people. So I just want you to think of that again, that these are namtars. So let's talk a little bit about how many people here have not been in any of these classes about the Karmapa? Welcome. Our school of Tibetan Buddhism is called Karma Kagyu. We have all these names I'm going to throw at you today, pardon me. And the head of our school is called Karmapa. The translation is the one who carries out the Buddha's activity. And right now, we're on the 17th generation. So you've probably heard of His Holiness Dalai Lama. He's also a type of reincarnating Lama. So let's start with number one, the first one. First one was Dzogchen Kempa. This is going back to our lineage, the first Karmapa. And when he died, he wrote a prediction letter. Also before he died, he set up and gave his lineage over orally. He shared all of his knowledge and teachings with specific teachers, often younger. So they get a little older, and they spent maybe a couple of years looking for them, maybe 3, maybe 10 years, hopefully not that. And then the prediction letter says where they're going to be found, what the village will be, what the parents' names are, were there unusual signs at the birth. Usually it's always like what region of Tibet. And then people go out and they don't tell it. Has anyone seen the movie Kundun? Kundun's great. Because Kundun is a great example of how someone is found. So the search party never lets on what they're all about. Often don't wear robes even. They'll just look like they're traitors. But they'll kind of search it out. Then they'll bring in the level two that will go in and more formally say, we believe your child is such and such, and can we meet him? And they never let on ever it would be a Dalai Lama or a Karmapa. They never let on to that level usually. So basically, this teacher had died, left a letter, it trained other people where to find him for the second generation. And eventually the child is found. And often stays at home for 5 years, maybe till they're 10 or something. Then they're brought to the monastery, which is rather traditional in Tibet, and where they're enthroned. But they're not assumed that they remember everything. So that person that was their student before is now their teacher. And they share them. They basically sort of like downloading all that information back to them. And then the second generation not only has that, but then they start developing even further. And then they have their next set of students. Often these are the same sets going back and forth. So in our tradition, we have His Holiness Gyawa Karmapa and his heart sons. Hopefully someday it'll be the heart daughters. I'm sorry. His heart sons would often be between 2 and 4, often including Sitö Rinpoche, Gyaltsa Rinpoche, Jamgon Rinpoche, and sometimes Shamar Rinpoche. And it would flip back and forth. So I remember I became Buddhist it was after the 60th Karmapa had died. I remember to this day going to the bookstore at the monastery, and they had a sign for $3, buy a lottery ticket to get a free trip to go to Tibet when the next Karmapa is found. I can't tell you how many of those I bought. I always wondered if the newer bookstore owners knew about that. Anyway, but it was a really exciting time. Everyone wondered where he was, and and you're going to learn later on about the 17th karma book, because that comes up in a couple of classes, I think, maybe one. But it was a very exciting time. We were kind of in between the teachers. But there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. So, and at that time, I remember meeting, and Kempa Rinpoche, one of our teachers of this center, made it a point to invite all of those head teachers if they could come to America so that we would start develop connections with them. So Gyaltsa Rinpoche was unable to come. I remember Sitja Rinpoche came, Jamar Rinpoche came. We had no idea who they were. We didn't have the books we have today, you know, and the internet. Now I sit there going, oh, what a special event those were. So that's kind of how it works, just for those of you that are new. So now we're up to the 17th Karmapa right now. And when did this start? The first Karmapa was born in 1110 AD, or current era. So it's been almost 900 years since our lineage has been going on and on. Can anyone share with me why they think this would be important? And by the way, I should say, and in Buddhism, we never say we're the best or anything. And we try not to think that way. But in our lineage, in Karma Kagyu, we were actually the first to do this. Later on, the Galupas, the Dalai Lama's group, he's on 14 right now. So, I think he's 14. So, but can anyone share with me why they think this would be important?
Having the tulku system, or the system of reincarnating lamas, makes it so that the teachings and traditions can be very well preserved.
Right.
Because if you take a child, I mean, obviously, yeah, even regardless of whether or not they're who they are, but if you just train them from a very young age with the entire tradition, then that way they can sort of like be almost a person who has all that knowledge so that it doesn't get lost.
Yeah. That's really true. It's truly a stream of continuity,
yeah.
and building an incredible foundation. So one big activity of the Karmapas centers around Buddhist scriptures. Many of you have probably heard of the Khanjur and Tanjur. The Khanjur, I always have to remind myself. The Khanjur are the actual words of the Buddha that were written down after he died. And in most monasteries, if you go to our monastery, we have a whole collection. And then on the other side of the main shrine room are the treatises, the Tanjur, Khanjur and the Tanjur. So the Karmapas are very involved in keeping that the integrity of that going. But also, all the teachers from the time of India onward had different commentaries and treatises on how to do certain practices and what revelations they had with their spiritual experiences. And so that would be written down. Milarepa and Marpa had amazing things that were written down about them, like all the songs of Milarepa and all the teachings from Marpa. So that's some of it. But the other important thing was how they preserved the lineage through these scriptures. The first Karmapa and the second and the ninth were accomplished in meditation, and so their writings focused on practice. The third, seventh, and eighth, Mikyo Dorje, they were very scholastic, so they wrote a lot about the sutras and tantras and commentaries. Jangmun Rinpoche was a contemporary of the 14th and the 15th Karmapa, and he was not a Karmapa, but he was a very special being. One of the books that he wrote was The Great Path of Awakening, Lama Kathy's favorite book, on sending and receiving, on Lojong. And so he also wrote the most beautiful, a great deal of our prayers come from him, calling the guru from apar, from afar. And he wrote the Treasury of Knowledge, of the treasury of the Kagyu Mahayana practices. And he wrote, these books were never before, up until about 10 years ago, translated into English. It's over 100 volumes. It's called The Five Treasuries. And if you can, you should either go on our website from our monastery or Amazon or wherever and try and find them, because they're very rare but very, very special to have. And then the Karmapas were instrumental not only in preserving our lineage but helped with other lineages in terms of their text, including helping preserve and continuing the sutras, the tantras of Mahamudra lineages. With the Shangpa Kagyu, the 14th Karmapa had something to do with that, which is the lineage of Kali Rinpoche centers. They're part of that tradition, but it was almost lost. And then the other interesting thing is that Karmapas have always taken it upon themselves to make copies of things. So the 15th and later on the 16th, I remember one time at our monastery, we had to move a whole lot of books, and there were a couple of hundred of us there. So we stood in lines as we got to move all these books. It was rather amazing. And it was the Khandur and the Tandur that the Karmapa 16th had printed when he was young. He had money, and he decided to go. They set up with a printing press in India because they had foreshadowed what was going to happen in Tibet, and they had it printed, and it was sent to every center. And I believe our center had a copy until the fire. We'll get a copy again. So it's pretty amazing, kind of just a quick overview and snapshot of their activities. Of course, go far beyond working with text, but they have even our lives are very affected by the direction of the 16th Karmapa when they decided to start coming to America and sharing the Dharma with not just America but with the West. It was His Holiness 16th Karmapa that decided what practices we should learn. And because he knew we were educated differently, but he knew we would understand Chenrezig, and then starting Ngundro, and then moving on to all the other ones as they unfolded over time. So even though they're really kind of high up, their fingers right on the pulse of, because that is their concern. So anyway, that was just kind of a little intro on that. So let's get into these two Karmapas. And I think I'm going to use the old-fashioned book, but I am going to show pictures for a second. One beautiful thing about the newer book, which I feel in some ways is maybe a continuation of this book, is there's a picture for each Karmapa. These aren't normal pictures. They're very symbolic. And what I really enjoy, this is very special paper. On one side is the picture. I don't know if all of you have this book, but on the back side, I had this book, I never looked at it. I was kind of shocked. On the back side is a shadow picture showing who everybody is. And not that I can figure out who everyone is. And often the Namtar itself won't go into this, but it's identical here. And the first time we were all exposed to this, Chogyam Trungpa had everything to do with this book being translated in the West. And so it would come out like that, which is still very nice. The style of art is Karma Gadri. There's always a deity in a corner. The Karmapa is always holding something specific in his hands. The people he taught or learned from is on one side, and usually his protector is there. So let's begin with Karmapa, the 14th Karmapa. His name is Tekchok Dorje. I'm going to read a little bit from the book, but I better watch my time. Okay. So just to show this picture, in one corner, and if it's in color, is a red person standing. It is a type of red Chenrezig. In the lower corner, the protector is a woman called Sering Ma. She's in Mahakala practice. She's a long life practitioner, and she protects the practitioner from anything, so they have a long life. And in fact, the 14th Karmapa lived for 77 years, which is considered pretty long in those days. He was born in eastern Tibet. By the way, most of our Karmapas were, because most of our teachers were the eastern Tibetans. I won't say anything more. We're kind of out there. He was born in the year of the fire snake. So they always then go into the mom. During her pregnancy, she had several auspicious dreams indicating that she had a tulku or incarnate child in her. It was recorded that on the day of his birth, rainbows appeared and flowers bloomed, even though it was the middle of winter. The newborn child was heard to recite the Sanskrit alphabet mantra, the Ali Kali mantra, some of us know. And he also said, Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, you can take all of this with a grain of rice, since we're talking Tibetans or some barley. But this is very much how each birth is spoken of, how the mother's condition was. In some of the other books, it says the mother dreamt that the former Karmapa appeared to her and said, I'll be seeing you soon. And so so that was the birth. The news of the prodigy traveled quickly, and the search party was dispatched. This party, having reached that area, met two other search parties, including one with Sita Rinpoche and one with Gyaltsa Rinpoche. So three search parties came for this child, which is rather unusual. Together, they conducted the child to a special monastery where they tested him and determined that he was a Karmapa. He was ordained as a novice and given lay precepts by Sita Rinpoche. And later on, he was enthroned by Sita Rinpoche. So for a few years, he did not live at Serpu, not until he was about 10. After he was enthroned and received the black crown hat, the 14th Karmapa then moved to Serpu, where he continued his studies. And it said that it was there that he lived in the same apartment where the former Karmapa had lived. And at the age of 19, then he was fully ordained as a monk by Sita Rinpoche. And then I want to kind of look at some of my notes. I wanted to kind of go over some of his characteristics. It's really hard when you study two Karmapas, they become one. Sort of have a 14, 15 Karmapa. So he was very much of a scholar. And through his life, he was a very humble, quiet Karmapa, known for being very disciplined. But he was very artistic. He excelled in art, in painting deities, in sculpting, metal casting, sewing applique images. He also contributed and changed some of the dances that they do at the monasteries on New Year's. They have entire weeks where they do special lama dancing where they wear masks. And so he designed a completely different one based on a vision from Padmasambhava. He also enjoyed astrology, grammar, poetry, and agriculture. He was very hands-on, and he built stupas at Serpu, did the full details on inside and out, and he also was into the restoration of buildings at Serpu. So then we should talk about, then at a certain age in his life, they started letting him travel, and he started blessing people. And one unique thing that I wanted to talk about, have any of the other classes talked about the great encampments? Maybe not. So Serpu Monastery is not in eastern Tibet. It's more centralized. So many people of the Karmakagyu tradition and many teachers, it would be weeks, journeys by foot and having yaks carrying your supplies to get to even see the Karmapa. So starting with about the fourth Karmapa, they completely changed the game. They decided, well, in the warmer months, it started, and then it started becoming a year-round thing. They had the great encampments. So it was basically a gigantic moving cities where they would stay somewhere maybe for months and where they would teach. They would be self-sufficient, so they wouldn't, we're talking sometimes upwards of 1,000 monks. And if you were there, it was considered a monastery. You were vegetarian, which was unheard of. Everyone talked about the white bean soups because Tibetans mostly ate meat. They really liked their meat. And there they had the colleges, the Shedras, the whole sections there. There were places to do 3-year retreats. There were places where you had regular classes all the time. And they were the artists, the Karmagogri style of art was developed there, a painting. It's one hairbrush type painting. It's a really beautiful style of painting. And so it was rather fascinating. So it traveled all over Tibet, and it would be sometimes very slow, but it was very effective because what happened was they got to spread the teachings to whole areas. And so the word would be out, and people would come and be there for quite some time. And each person that was part of the encampment had their own tent. They said it was big enough just to come over on top of you. You know, like we're not talking about a nice big Coleman tent, you know. But I think it's pretty amazing that they had this type of technology and that they did this. Because the monastery was wonderful, but so many people could visit you in a monastery. But when you're out on the plains of Tibet, thousands and thousands of people would come. So when he was about 14, he left the monastery and went with one of the great encampments all over Tibet to give people different empowerments. Okay, so let's go on. Are there any questions yet? So I must say, of all the books, this book is pretty amazing. This is from a French translation. It's so detailed, I can't get over it. Very enriching of their lives, just to let you know. Uh-oh, I'm not on the 16th Karmapa. Better be careful here. I think then the most important thing I'll talk about next, and I'm going to read from Jama Rinpoche's book, is the Rime movement. Are any of you familiar with the Rime movement? I've always heard about it, but I wouldn't say I was really as well versed as I am now because I've been doing a lot of sort of studying about it. This is, let's see, where did I put it? I think I have my own handout on it. So at this time, the Karmapa was a grown man, and he was getting teachings from, he'd already gotten teachings from Sitra Rinpoche and others. But throughout the land of, especially eastern Tibet, there was a movement in the Shakya, the Nyingma, and the Kagyu lineage that they didn't want they didn't want the Galupas to decide what they studied. And they realized a lot of teachings were getting lost, and a lot of the practices were really hard and stodgy, and where you would have to do so many pages before you would even get to a mantra. And for the everyday person, people were not so interested in Buddhism at that point. So this was a movement, not a special school of Buddhism, but an actual movement that is active today. The 14th and the 15th onward, those Karmapas got involved in it. As, of course, Jama Rinpoche was one of the founders of it. Kala Rinpoche's parents, I remember reading about it, they were actively involved in this movement. And I thought it would be nice to read about just for a second. It said the movement was initiated by a number of 19th century scholars and teachers. Jama Kantu Rinpoche, Kenzi Wampo, Pachu Rinpoche, and Chochur Limpa, who was a famous Tertön. And the teachers had a number of objectives in mind. And the three most important were to preserve the rare teachings, to discourage sectarian principles and prejudice, and to reemphasize practice for the everyday life. And it sounds really simple, but it was a daunting task. And that's one reason why Jama Rinpoche wrote the Five Treasuries, because it was the entire compendium of all Buddhism that was present at that time. So anyway, so that was, those were his peers, his modern day people. Those three men, I actually said four, but it was Jama Rinpoche, who was an exquisite scholar, Jama Kenzi Wangpo, who the Kenzi lineage is so famous that there's still many Kenzis today, was one of the contemporaries, as was Chokyur Limpa, who was a Tertön of the Nyingma tradition, who could find hidden treasures and everything. So those three got together and worked with the Karmapa and others to come up with, try to simplify the text. But at the same time, they spent years doing research of what was lost and all that. Better watch the time. So before the Karmapa died, he gave his entire stream of knowledge to Jamakanta Rinpoche. And he had an attendant who he gave his letter saying, this is where I'll be found next. And he died at a really nice age of 77. So that's kind of closing that door. There's so much more to say about them, but we're going to close that door because we have another Karmapa to talk about. There is a really nice, of all places, Wikipedia has a really nice handout on the Rime movement. The translation is unbiased. That's what it means, to be unbiased. And Jamar Rinpoche almost took it as a vow not to be biased about things. And so it's a very powerful talk about, it's just so involved, we could have a whole class on that. Okay, we talked about the encampment. I'm down to the 15th. The 15th Karmapa was found and 3 years later in 1871. He had a shorter life until 1922. Now, you must remember, and I didn't mention, but with both of them, they also had close ties with the Dalai Lama. In fact, the 14th helped find the 9th Dalai Lama. He had a prediction where he would be found. Karmapas are famous for predicting where certain teachers will be found. So both of them were very close. And this was a time where the Rime movement, I believe, really helped unify a lot of people before they had to leave Tibet. It unified a lot of the teachings. And they say without it, those teachings would have all been lost because of what was coming up. Okay, so the big invasions were going to happen in the 50s, and we're up to 1871 now. So when he was born, he was born with tufts of hair between his eyebrows like the Buddha. It was considered one of the 32 signs of a Buddha. We're on 15. His name is Kyabgyab Dorje. He was said to be reciting Om Mani Padme Hum when he was born. And his early life was somewhat quiet, but it picked up pretty well for him. I'm going to find... We'll read this. This is so good. And in this picture of him, it shows his deity to be Amitayus, which is long life Amitabha practice. And his protector is Two-Arm Mahakala. But in the more modern book, it's another form of Mahakala and Mahakali and Yab-Yam and Union. So it does vary sometimes depending on the book and the artist. So the 15th Karmapa was born in central Tibet, which is rather unusual, in the Iron Sheep Year. I mentioned the white tuft of hair between his eyebrows. He displayed remarkable intelligence at a tender age, and by the time he was 4, he was composing prayers. At the age of 6, he was recognized as the new Karmapa, and in accordance with the details in the letter of prediction that he left behind, that the 14th left, he was officially recognized by Jamakanta, we talked about him, by Jamyang Khyentse Wangpo. And I don't believe Chogyam Rinpoche was still alive. So two of the major teachers that had been his students before were now going to be his teachers, two of the major founders of the Rime movement. He was an assiduous student, and even when young, was taught basic Mahayana, Dharma, logic, and astrology. At the age of 8, he constructed a Mahakala shrine and composed a prayer to him. It was actually said in other books he appeared to him. In 1881, so he would have been 17 years of age, he and an entourage paid a visit to the 13th Dalai Lama in order to have a deeper connection with him. In 1886, a few years later, he went to visit Khantum Rinpoche, which is way over in eastern Tibet, and said that he stayed there 3 years. The aged scholar, John Cantrell, gave Karmapa the empowerments, so often not just teachings, but empowerments would be shared. He gave them all the empowerments that the earlier Karmapa had given him, textual transmissions, and instructions of the five treasures. And this series, as I said earlier, contained over 100 volumes, annotated and commented, again, by Jamar Rinpoche. This was Jamar Rinpoche Lodrutai the Great. He was the first Jamar Rinpoche. We're going to talk about the second soon. The third was the one I met in the 70s and 80s. And then the fourth, I think a lot of you know of, any of you see him? He was at the lot of the Munlams. He's taken his robes off. He's studying medicine. Hopefully he'll come back because he has a lot of, he has a big role to play, I think, as a Jamar Cantrell. So he went to that part of to eastern Tibet at the Palpung Monastery. And as I said, they say he was there for over 2 to 3 years. And since he was over there, then he went over and visited Jamyun Khyentse Wangpo Rinpoche and received even more empowerments from him. A really interesting story is throughout his life, he was determined to get as many teachings from all the different lineages. And so we talked about a tiny bit about the Chogyur Limpa from the Nyingma tradition, who was just absolutely brilliant. He was gone, and by this time, some of his grandchildren were teachers. And so the 15th Karmapa invited one to come and give him all the teachings. He wanted the transmission of his lineage. This is really common for, like, Dalai Lama and Karmapas to have these type of transmissions. And he said, no, I'm not worthy enough. So the second one, the Karmapa didn't tell him. He just invited him over. And they say he walked in the room. There was a throne set up. There were all these robes everywhere. And I think that meant he had to sit on the throne and read everything to the Karmapa. And he tried to talk his way out, but he knew that wasn't going to happen. So this is how the Karmapa got that transmission. So Karmapa was a very... I didn't talk much about it. How many of you met the present Karmapa? Would you say it's pretty powerful? I heard in those days these guys were really powerful. I remember if any of you have time and you're bored in the summer and want to read a great book, read Blazing Splendor by Tulku Urgen Rinpoche. He tells the best stories in the land, and he recounts the time of right before, like, the glorious heydays of Tibet before they were invaded by China, and goes through the Karmapa making him move to Nepal and set up monasteries, because the Karmapa set people out way ahead of time to start setting up to get ready for everyone to move out of Tibet. But he was the nephew of the monk that had to do the reading transmission and for the Karmapa. And by the way, he's the father of Mingyur Rinpoche. They're all connected after a while. So it's all pretty splendid. Anyway, I stop getting excited. Just calm down. And I was very, very fortunate my husband and I got to live in India in 89-90. I got to see Jamar Rinpoche the third before he was in a car accident. And I remember he begged me to talk to him. I was taking Tibetan, begged me to say things in Tibetan. I'm like, no, no, no. And I really wish I had now, because I'm sure he would have removed a lot of my obstacles of learning Tibetan. But we're all very, very fortunate to have a Karmapa now who is so special, so accessible. He puts everything on YouTube for free. Please remember that. Go there. All right. So continuing on. So one other very interesting thing about this Karmapa was it was discovered he was a Tertön. Because remember, he got that transmission from the Terma lineage. And from his name was Lama Sonam. And so he could actually, a Tertön is someone, so there's Termas. Padmasambhava in the Nyingma lineage, Padmasambhava is the head, and he left many hundreds and hundreds of treasures, mined and actual objects to be discovered centuries later. Karmapa had this ability. And normally, if you were a Tertön, you would learn how to go to those places, but the Karmapa was too busy. So the protectors of the objects would come to him. They said his room was just filled with all these objects. And if you're a Tertön, normally you're always married. That it's how it is. And Karmapas are never married. So Karmapa became very ill, and his teacher said, you have to get married. You have to have a relationship with women. So he got married. He had several wives or consorts. His first was a woman who was famous for working with these objects and for having those type of visions also, because often the wives are as powerful as the men. And then later on, he had another wife called the Great Dakini, the Great Khandro. And it's said that the 16th Karmapa, when he escaped Tibet, took her with him, because by then, of course, the 15th was gone. And she, after her husband died, she went into full retreat for the rest of her life. So a really interesting side story is this Karmapa had three sons. And one of them was Kempo Karcha Rinpoche's teacher. We all saw the poster in this room, right? Remember the poster, that one teacher in Kempo Rinpoche's room? So he was the second Jama Rinpoche. So Jama Rinpoche was gone by then. His name is Palden Khentse Ösel, and he was born in Serpu of the 15th Karmapa. And at the age of 12, he was recognized as a Jama Rinpoche, of course, and enthroned at Serpu. He spent many of his years at another monastery, full education, and they say he was one of the most astute Mahamudra practitioners and teachers of the land. And our teacher, Kempo Karcha Rinpoche, was a student of his and said just meeting him completely changed his life. So I'm very grateful of that meeting. And there had never been a photo of him, and maybe 20 years ago, someone came from Tibet, saw Kempo Rinpoche, and gave him a little photo, which they blew up to a gigantic poster that's in Kempo Rinpoche's room. So if you're ever at Karmi Ling, ask to see the picture, because he's part of the 15th Karma of his lineage. So how is our time? Oh, we're almost out of time. So originally, this Karmapa was so sick as he was getting older. He had drawn up basically his prediction letter of who was going to do what. And then he met that one woman, his last consort, who he's with for years. And so he lived a much longer life. And so he had to completely change everything of where he was going to be reborn and everything. And then he passed away with full miracles as he was passing. And so I thought for a few minutes, we only have a few minutes left. Are there any pressing questions? I mean, this is just hearsay I'm sharing with you, but please read the books. They're very inspiring. And with the internet, it really will enrich your understanding, I think, of the times. And reading books like Blazing Splendor really, I think, fill in the gap of what a wondrous traditions we're part of. And so the prayer we read originally this morning was all about this tradition. Our present Karmapa, as many of you know, has had some obstacles regarding his citizenship. So we don't get to see him as much. So I thought for a few minutes we could chant Om Mani Padme Hum for him. And then after that, we'll chant Karmapa Chöno. So if you're new and you've never chanted, I'm sorry, I don't think our book has Om Mani Padme Hum in it, does it? But we'll just chant it for a few minutes. Do we have any Om Mani Padme Hums or anyone? No. We'll just do this for a few minutes. If this is new to you, you can just rest your mind for a moment. We'll just do this for a few minutes. And we'll just let's chant together for one whole mala. We'll just say it out loud together. We'll sing it. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 And the second mantra is Karmapa Chöno, which is Karmapa, please know my mind. I'm not used to singing it to a tune. Karmapa Chöno. 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 So before we leave here today, I hope if nothing else, this series shows us how blessed we are, how everything from the basic instructions on how to meditate, how to live our lives, what practices we do, how to say mantras, how to develop compassion. This is all due to the kindness of Lord Buddha and the Karmapas who are his activity that have gone on for almost 900 years. Thank you so much, everyone. May we offer the merit for all beings to remove suffering. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.